live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. You are listening to the February 2013 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane Armonroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, better late than never, I say. This is the February program. It comes out a little bit late, but you'll be happy to know that the next few shows are going to be our Commodore 64 anniversary special. Now, those of you who used to listen to Retro Gaming Radio back in the classic days know that I did a four-piece show on the Amiga computer. The Commodore 64 is one of the greatest computers of all time, and here on Retro Gaming Radio, we're going to give that fantastic computer its due. So for the next couple of episodes, we will not be running the standard format of the show. We won't have bits and bytes or some of the other regular pieces, but instead, we're going to focus full-time on this fantastic computer. This month we're going to talk about the history of the Commodore 64. We're going to talk all about its beginnings and its ends and all the stops it made along the way. In future shows we're going to look over the software and the hardware that make this such an amazing computer. And then I've got, of course, some great stories to tell you. So I hope you enjoy, sit back, relax, and let's relive the Commodore 64. The Commodore 64 was released by Commodore in September of 1982. Now, the Commodore 64 started off at a price tag of $595. Now, that sounds expensive, right, considering most of us that wear wristwatches have more power in our wristwatch, our cell phone. Pretty much any device you could lay your hands on right now has 100 times more power than the Commodore 64. But it's worth noting that the $595 price tag was very important to Commodore in 1982 because other microcomputers cost almost double, and in some cases, triple $595. So for Commodore to be able to come out with a machine, a micro machine, for that price at that time frame was very, very important. It's worth noting that the Commodore 64 sold over 20 million units in its lifetime. At one point, it was estimated that in the United States, there was a Commodore 64 in one of every four homes. That's an amazing number. 1982 was a great year. When we talk about Commodore and being great years, the Commodore 64 was not an expandable, very much of an expandable computer. These days, we have PCs that you can just pull the video card out and put another one in. Pull the sound card out, put another one in. This was not a modular device. This was pretty much what you see is what you get. So maybe it's worth going over the basic specs of the Commodore 64. The Commodore 64 used a 6502 processor, depending on what region of the world you were in, ran just under or just over 1 megahertz. Now, let me repeat that one more time. 1 megahertz. Not 1 gigahertz. 1 megahertz. It used a VIC-2 chip for graphics at 320 by 200 resolution. Now again, 320 pixels by 200 pixels. Pretty much the lowest resolution computer that you could lay your hands on today with the worst monitor possible would still be double that resolution. It was capable of 16 colors, which was actually pretty miraculous at the time considering most microcomputers were black and white. It also featured some things like hardware sprites and raster interrupts. These were very important to graphics. Let's talk a little bit about that because it's part of what makes the Commodore 64 so amazing. Hardware sprites. Think of a sprite as something on the screen that moves around. The player, the monster, an arrow, a bullet. You may have heard it called player missile graphics. Well, in the case of the Commodore 64, these player missile graphics didn't have just software built in to handle them. In some cases, as I recall, the Atari 400-800 had something called player missile graphics, but it was more of an API to help you use graphics to do players and missiles and weapons and bad guys and the whole bit. The Commodore 64 actually had hardware to control those, which means to get the same sort of effect on other microcomputers, you would have a lot of flickering, you would have a lot of dirt, what we call ghosting or little specks, right? Artifacting on the graphics. Well, because they're controlled by the hardware, you could get away with doing some miraculous things with sprites that you really couldn't get away with doing on other microcomputers at the time. Raster interrupts allowed you to tap into the hardware and actually tell the hardware to control things in your stead. But here's the cool part. If you've done any programming, you know that typically speaking, if you're writing a game, you'll have a main loop, and the main loop essentially changes values, moves where the graphics are going to be, then paints the graphics, wash, rinse, and repeat. Raster interrupts allowed you to actually tap into the hardware and say, at certain periodicities, at certain time frames, update these graphics. So you could almost have, look at it as almost multitasking on a computer that's made in 1982. So these sort of unbelievable, even though the resolution wasn't incredible, the unbelievable features of the hardware, the graphics hardware, really made a huge difference in the Commodore 64. And if you've gamed on one, you know what I'm talking about. The Commodore 64 boasted 64 kilobytes, not megabytes, not gigabytes, but 64 kilobytes of RAM. Now, for those of you who are well-versed in Commodore 64, you know when you turn the Commodore 64 on, it will only tell you that you have 38,000 bytes to work with. Some of that was reserved for the system. It still had 64K, just not necessarily 64K usable. But some people got around that, and I'll talk about more about that in the story section of this program. Now, what really set the Commodore 64 apart, now, the graphics were fantastic. It was an amazingly inexpensive computer for the time. But what really put the Commodore 64 miles ahead of everything else that had come before it was the SID chip, the sound interface device. SID, the 6581 chip, was actually a synthesizer. Well, there was Yamahas and other Kawasaki-type synthesizers out on the market, actual keyboards that could do these incredible things. To have one in a computer was simply unheard of. Most monochrome computers got to beep or play what they called speaker sounds, which was this tinny, hollow, one-tone with a variation of pitch. You know what I'm talking about. It's just absolutely horrible. But the SID chip changed the way that computers thought about sound. It had three voices plus a noise channel, and it had all of the features that a synthesizer would have: attack, decay, sustain, release, all of the things that could really make the Commodore 64 not just stand out graphically or by price, but by the audio. The sound that came out of it was simply amazing. And anybody who's been in the Commodore 64 area knows exactly what I'm talking about. And as the system progressed, they learned to do more and more with the Commodore 64 sound system. And we're going to talk more about how they expanded it with hardware later on. The system came complete with a few ports on it, two joystick ports, which were standard 9-pin ports. Commodore is very smart in some respects. Now, they're not smart in a lot of respects, but in some respects they were. They made their joystick ports compatible with the best-selling video game system of the time. That would be the Atari 2600. So you had two joystick ports. You could have two players at one time, a cartridge port on the backside, RF out so you could hook it up to any TV, audio-video out using a special IEEE connector that would allow you to hook it up to an actual monitor at the time, a floppy printer IEEE port, a cassette tape plug, and an RS-232 port. So all in all, this thing was pretty expandable on the outside. Not necessarily on the inside, but you could do a lot of stuff with it on the outside, which was pretty neat. Here's an interesting little bit of trivia. The power supply to the Commodore 64, as you know, was affectionately known as the brick. Now, a lot of people wondered. Now, at the time, right, the IBM PC and a lot of the other computers at the time had the power supply built into the unit, which not only added great size to the unit, but it also added heat and other unpleasantness to those computers. Commodore decided that it would make sense to make an external power supply, and there's a couple reasons for that. One, it saves space in the unit, allowing the Commodore 64 to sit nice and cleanly on your desk. It also reduced heat that you would have to worry about being near your components on the inside. And finally, the one little piece of the equation I did not know about when I started researching this piece was the fact that the external power supply allowed them to easily change that power supply out in other countries, because most countries don't share the same type of power plug or the same voltage or anything else. So instead of actually having to manufacture new Commodore 64s for every different location, they could, in fact, simply replace the power supply. It also made it easy for users to replace the power supply. And that was important because as the Commodore 64 started powering more devices, it required more power draw. Just like today, if you put a very high-end video card in your PC, you may have to upgrade the power supply simply to drive the components themselves. So that was fantastic. It was very interesting, though. They were very protective of their power supply, Commodore. For those of you who have ever actually opened one of those power supplies, there's an amazing amount of epoxy resin. There's a gel inside that thing to actually keep you from getting inside and tampering with it. And I'm not sure if that was to prevent reverse engineering or if it was just to protect the consumer from themselves or if it just made sure that nobody would knock one of these things off and start selling them for cheap, which they ended up doing anyway. But that actually helped dissipate the heat of the power supply as well. So the epoxy resin was actually useful in many different aspects. So now you know a little bit about the hardware. Now, we're going to get into more details about this in future shows. However, this episode, we're going to talk strictly about the history of the Commodore 64 and some of the titles of games that came out that people remember, that people are would consider significant releases. Now, I threw a couple of games in there for myself that maybe a lot of you haven't heard of, and I did try to respect some of our overseas compadres who also liked the Commodore 64, but ended up playing some very different games than some of us did. So let's go back to 1982 in September. Again, the unit started off at $595. There was no floppy drive available at the time. However, there was something called a data set, a cassette recorder playback unit that plugged into the computer that you could save and load programs off of. As mentioned, over 20 million Commodore 64s sold by 1999 in October. 1982 saw some amazing games. Some of the games, now you've got to understand, there's a nostalgia for many of us, right? 1982, let's see, I graduated in 87, so 5 years before that. I wasn't in high school, I was in junior high school. So junior high school, these are the times that we tend to remember, that we tend to reminisce about, the times we go all nostalgia over. So a lot of these games mean a lot to me personally and a lot of my listeners who grew up around the same time frame. However, I do want to point out that nostalgia is not the only pair of glasses that one needs to wear to truly appreciate these games. Some of these games are still fun even today to play. In 1982, we saw a couple of really, really neat titles, right? We saw Choplifter, which everybody knows Choplifter, and in fact, it's still being redone today. Right, they just had a Choplifter HD that came out for consoles and for other devices. So Choplifter's been around a long time. Ford Apocalypse is one of the greatest games ever. It has you flying an attack helicopter through the caverns, through these caverns, taking out bad guys. It's an amazing experience that belies the fact that it's on an 8-bit computer from the past. And the other title that really came out notable in 1982 was Night Mission Pinball. Now, Night Mission Pinball was a fully functional pinball machine inside your Commodore 64. Now, a lot of people don't remember Night Mission Pinball. Instead, they remember some other things that we're going to talk about related to pinball in the near future here in a moment. In just a few months, now this is amazing to me. This shows, and we're going to talk more about this in a minute, but this shows an amazing ability of Commodore's not just to create a low-cost product, a quality product, but then to manufacture it down to a point to where they can make it even more affordable. We're going to talk about how the price changed over a very short period of time. By January of 1983, this is 4 months after the Commodore 64 came out, 4 months, the price dropped from $595 to $399 or $400. That's an amazing cut. What is that, 33%? I'd have to do the math, right? I didn't write down my math on my notes. But that's an insane amount of money to drop in a few months. So that's one of those things where you got to look at saying, okay, so it came out, everybody wanted it, but $600, there's no way. Well, what about $400? Just 6 months later, Commodore dropped the dealer price, in other words, what the dealers could purchase them for, down to, get this, $200. This is within the first year, my friends. This is how smart and efficient Commodore was, that they could afford to do that. Now, they weren't losing any money. Okay, folks, let me just put it this way. They were not losing a single dime by lowering that price tag. They were continuing to make money. And we're going to talk about how that works in just a minute. By selling them for $200 to dealers, that dropped the retail price well under $250. The Commodore 64 was then affordable to almost anybody, especially when you start looking at the concept that the other computers were still running for a grand. You know what I'm saying? So this is absolutely a stunning deal. We now have one of the most powerful personal computers on the market, now down to under $250. Now that's 1983 dollars, of course, you know, so you'd have to adjust for inflation, but you got the idea. During the end of 1983, we saw Electronic Arts blossom. We all know who Electronic Arts is now, but Electronic Arts, back in the old days, was actually not a big evil corporation that kept their employees working 80-hour weeks and locking them into their campuses and paying them peanuts. Electronic Arts was a publishing house that really wanted to go out and get the top-name talent, the top-name software. So by October, they had released three landmark games that put Electronic Arts immediately on the map. These games would be Pinball Construction Set, which most people know a lot more than they know about Night Mission Pinball, the insanely popular game Mule, and of course, one of my all-time favorite games from Freefall Associates, Archon. Archon has never been done right since the original incarnation of Archon on the Commodore 64. They've made sequels, they've made remakes, they've tried to do high-def versions. It just doesn't work. Archon was magic on its own. Now, in order to facilitate Electronic Arts, Commodore released the 1541 disk drive right around October of 1983. So within a year, the Commodore 64 had several top-notch games. They had a floppy drive, and they had Electronic Arts bringing some amazing talent. Some other notable titles that you might recognize from 1983. Now listen, 1983 must be the greatest year of gaming of all time. As I read you these titles, just think about it. 1983, listen to the lineup. The original Beachhead, Blue Max, Burnin' Rubber, Dino Eggs, Crush Crumble Chomp, Temple of Apshai, Forbidden Forest, Grid Runner, Hover Bover, Jumpman, Load Runner, Miner 2049er, Pharaoh's Curse, Telengard. Now, this is just a small sampling, folks, just in case you're wondering. I didn't list them all, but I listed the ones that I thought a lot of people would recognize, that a lot of people would be like, holy crap, 1983 was insane. And it was. David Crane's mythological Ghostbusters hit the Commodore 64 by mid-1984. And by the end of 1984, they had sold 3.5 million units by December 1984. So we're talking 2 years, just a little bit above 2 years. They'd had two good Christmas seasons, technically three, but if you released it in September, that's a little tight. So they had two full Christmas seasons, 3.5 million units shipped. Unbelievable. I know what you're thinking. Well, what else came out in 1984? There's got to be some other great games. If 1983 was the gold, 1984 was the silver. Let's go over the big titles. Decathlon, which single-handedly broke wrists and joysticks simultaneously. Aztec Challenge, BC's Quest for Tires, Bruce Lee, Chucky Egg, David's Midnight Magic, the other pinball machine everyone knows, Gateway to Abshai, Gyrus, Hero, Impossible Mission, Jet Set Willy, Dr. J and Larry Bird Go One-on-One, David Crane's Pitfall, Raid Over Moscow, Raid on Bungling Bay, Seven Cities of Gold, Space Taxi, Spy Hunter, Spy vs. Spy, Toy Bazaar, all 1984, if you can believe it. Definitely the silver medal. In 1985, the Commodore 128 gets announced. And we also see the first fast loader cartridge called the Mach 5. Now, of course, we all know what the Mach 5 reference is, and if you don't, you're just not geeky enough to be listening to the show. The Mach 5, of course, was the name of Speed Racer's infamous car, the Mach 5. It was also a fairly decent fast loader cartridge. Of course, that's not the one that everybody remembers, is it? No, that title goes to the Epix fast load cartridge, which we're going to be talking about in great detail later on. 1985 also saw a bunch of big names. If 1983 was the gold, 1984 was the silver, 1985 would definitely take the bronze medal. Now, a lot of people who are a bit younger than me, just by a tad bit, for them, this is, I mean, there's a lot of titles in here that people will go, oh my God, that's like, that totally trumps anything in 1983 or 1984. I beg to differ. But let me run down the list and you'll tell me what you think. 1985 saw the release of the big name titles. Most of the Lucasfilm games came out, like Ball Blazer, Rescue on Fractalis, the infamous Bard's Tale. Activision started pumping out some really good titles like Hacker, which, by the way, the logon password is Australia. Elite, of course, that's a huge fan favorite. F-15 Strike Eagle, Beachhead 2, Little Computer People, The Last V8, Paradroid, Way of the Exploding Fist. All of these fantastic titles, right? This would be my high school years. So obviously, by then I had a pretty decent Commodore 64 collection going on. One of the huge things that happened in the history of telecommunications happened in 1985. A little thing called QuantumLink started up. QuantumLink was also affectionately known as Q-Link. And Q-Link truly changed the way that people communicated. Now listen, at this point in time, let me see if I've got a number for right about now, how many units were out there. I'm figuring we're in the 4 to 4.5 million units. So Q-Link was the first nationwide pay bulletin board system. What does that mean for those of you who are not quite of age to appreciate it? QuantumLink was a combination of software and your modem. Now when I say modem, I'm not talking cable modem. I'm not talking about, 56K modem. I'm talking about really, really old modems. And we're going to talk a lot about that in the hardware portion of the show. Q-Link actually came on a disc. Now, this is what's important. Now, we had bulletin boards by then. We had the ones where you would call out on your modem and some text would come on the screen. It would say log in and you type in your name and you type in your password. And maybe you would have some block graphics or something that would slowly draw in. But for the most part, it was a plain textual interface. And bulletin boards at the time could only support one, maybe two people online at the same time. So a standard bulletin board would have somebody call, read messages, leave their responses, right? Leave their responses, hang up. The next person would call. They would read all the messages, leave their responses, hang up, and this would continue 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's actually, you know, that's sort of the precursor to social networking, if you will, right? Because most of the time, now, I know there's obviously there's some variances in this, but typically speaking, if you go up to Google Plus, or you go up to Facebook, or you go up to Twitter, you read, you respond, and then you come back later and wash, rinse, and repeat, right? That's how regular BBSs were back in the early 80s. And there were a lot of these. Q-Link became the first nationwide, I wouldn't call it an ISP, but I would call it a nationwide bulletin board where hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people could be connected online at the same time. Now, I know what you're thinking. There was CompuServe, there was Genie, there were some other ones out there that offered something similar. You could be in a text chat room with 50 people. It wasn't impossible. Q-Link took it one step further. Instead of saying, use your favorite terminal software to call CompuServe or Genie or what's the other one, Prodigy, instead of calling up with your software, we're going to give you a disk, and this is how you're going to get into the system. And as soon as you put that disk in and booted it, it was a world. It was a full color. It was graphics. It was beautiful interface. It was something that even the diehard bulletin board people had to look at and go, holy crap, that's insane. And as Q-Link got bigger, they offered online games, blackjack, slots, right? This is 1985. Right? This is almost 30 years ago. They were playing online blackjack on Commodore 64s in full color with graphics. So it's important to understand what Q-Link really meant to the world. This pushed the CompuServes and the Genies and all these other ones. It pushed them to better themselves. Oddly enough, Q-Link also was a file repository. So Q-Link kind of offered several different things. It offered bulletin board style, you know, leave a message, read a message, leave a message, right? It allowed real-time chat with a variety of different chat rooms. It also had a file server, right? And then, of course, later on it had games added to it. The file server became a huge means of exchange, not piracy. There was plenty of that going on, but it wasn't on Q-Link. In fact, they watched very closely to maintain a very clean system. Most bulletin boards couldn't say the same. But what Q-Link started was a musical revolution. Now remember, we had the Commodore 64 here. A complete synthesizer. A real synthesizer. Three voice, one waveform. You could make insane music with this thing. A guy by the name of Craig Chamberlain came out with something called SID Player. And SID Player blew me away. Still today, I can be entranced with SID Player. What is SID Player? SID Player was a visual music playback machine that showed you a full two-row keyboard. And as the music would play, as the notes would play, or the sound effects would play, you would actually see the keys light up. Technically speaking, if you wanted to teach yourself piano, you could go and download, you know, a Beethoven song or Bach, and if, you know, it didn't have a lot of weird, you know, audio effects added to it, it was just a piano sound, you could learn how to play piano with this thing. SID Player came out and blew everybody away, but what really was important was SID Edit, or the SID Editor, which let you make the music to play inside of SID Player. Quantum Link, or Q-Link, became a repository. It became an outlet for hundreds, thousands of musicians to gather, exchange music, exchange ideas, and corroborate with each other. It was an amazing thing to live through. I talk often about, in Passenger Seat Radio, my other show, I talk a lot about being there when it happened, right? I was there when MP3 first took hold. I was there. I wrote, oddly enough, this is my claim to fame that nobody knows about, I wrote the first graphical MP3 encoder that the world had ever seen, which I still had a copy so I could prove it. Made in Visual Basic, what was it, the 3, 4, whatever it was at the time. But there are certain times in history, and it doesn't happen anymore, by the way, because everything is just handed to you. Everything is just there. To actually be present during a time frame, a relatively short time frame, a year or two, to see something that really changed the world, whether anybody knows it changed it or not, Quantum Link changed the world. And it may surprise you or not surprise you to find out that Quantum Link evolved. Once the Commodore 64 went its merry way, Q-Link took its back-end systems, repurposed it, and became, get this, the original biggest ISP of all time, America Online. In fact, there are hints, if you go and search for Quantum Link, and you can see pictures, graphic pictures in the chat rooms and things like that, you will actually see well-known America Online things like People Connection. That was the chat rooms, was People Connection. So, I'm no fan of AOL. But AOL would have never existed if not for Quantum Link. And AOL definitely, whether you like AOL or not, and I do not, whether you like it or not, it connected people in a mass frenzy. It would have taken them longer to get together had we waited for the inevitable evolution of the Internet. Quantum Link started it all on the Commodore 64. It wasn't available. I want to say that there eventually was a Q-Link available for like the Atari computers, but it was pretty much a Commodore 64 club only, which was fine because there was like 4 million of them out there to be had. And a lot of them had modems. I know what you're thinking. Well, the Commodore 64 didn't come with a modem. What's the conversion rate there? They started giving modems away with the computers. Now, that's another story altogether. I don't want to get into that. I've already kind of segued off on Q-Link, but it was so important in Commodore's history that Q-Link, SID Player, and the entire faction around that is so important we had to talk about it at length for me to feel happy about it. 1985 also saw Commodore attempt to stop production on the Commodore 64. See, Commodore wanted to move ahead. They wanted to move forward. They wanted to make the Commodore 128 their new flagship. They wanted to get the Commodore Amiga to be their flagship, right? They couldn't understand why the Commodore 64 continued to hold on, right? They didn't expect it to last as long as it did. So they tried to stop production. The public demanded more. They opened production back up. This happened several times during 1985. Berkeley Softworks came up with a little something that you may or may not have heard of called GEOS, the Graphical Environment Operating System. This was introduced in January of 1986. Now, the Commodore 128 had been out for about a year, and Commodore was pretty sure that if they could, they saw GEOS. They knew what GEOS represented. GEOS, just to give you an example, we'll have links and stuff for you, of course, but to understand what GEOS is, if you remember the black and white original monochrome Mac computers, right? The ones that people make fish aquariums and stuff out of now, they're like collector pieces. Those little rectangular boxes that sat on your desk with the little tiny viewport in them and the disk drive underneath. Those are the black and white Macs I'm talking about. GEOS, in 86 rather, GEOS provided that interface and then some. So it was a very big thing. Commodore saw that this was going to be the future, and they really wanted GEOS and the Commodore 128 to be a marriage. Well, the Commodore 128 had some problems getting started, even though the Commodore 128 was actually a remarkably decent machine. The Commodore 128 fell by the wayside for a simple reason, that it was 99.99999% backward compatible with, you got it, the Commodore 64. In fact, on the 128, if you powered the computer up holding down the Commodore key, it would boot directly into the Commodore 64 mode. You could also type Go64 on the in the command line interpreter there and hit enter, and it would also take you to the Commodore 64. Now, when we talk about hardware, you're going to learn all sorts of nasty stuff about the 128 and the also the Commodore 64C, which we're going to talk about in a minute, that did not make these what I would call 100% compatible. But Commodore was banking on the concept that you would get the 128 knowing you had backward compatibility, but then you'd stay for the GEOS, right? We're going to talk more about the 128 and the hardware segment because there's a reason why Commodore was banking on it. And when you spread yourself thin between two computers, it doesn't always work out the best. So GEOS was introduced in January of 1986. And June, a few months later, about 6 months later, about halfway through the year, Commodore decided, okay, fine. You guys want Commodore 64s? We'll give you freaking Commodore 64s. So they retooled it, they cleaned it up a little bit, and they called it the C64C. They also released a special C edition of the 1541. This was designed to be the... Okay, listen, you're not going to buy 128s. We got it. However, we still want you to use GEOS. We think this is the future. And honestly, I think they wanted people on GEOS because it was a gateway drug to the Amiga, right? You had the Commodore 64, blue screen, white letters, you type stuff in. Then you had GEOS, which was still black and white, but it was a graphic environment. Then the next step up, after you've had a little marijuana, right, because that's the gateway drug, then you upped yourself to the hard stuff, the crystal meth, the Amiga. Full color, all the audio, the whole bit. This is not an Amiga show. But they really wanted GEOS to be the gateway drug to the Amiga. If we can get them to use GEOS, they will upgrade to the Amiga. It's a logical progression. So the C64C and the 1541C came bundled with GEOS. So they were trying to make it work. This is a piece of the timeline. 1986 was important to me because of one title that came out. And the game itself was nothing to look at. Honestly, it wasn't even that good of a game, to be honest with you. But a little game called Transformers came out for the Commodore 64. It was created by the legendary master of all, David Crane. Now, why does this even register a blip on the Commodore 64 radar? Heck, a lot of you probably don't even know where I'm going with this or know what I'm talking about. But David Crane, as you know from Ghostbusters, right, he had a way of pushing hardware to the limit. That's when he worked at Activision for the Atari 2600, right? David Crane games were legend. Activision games on the 2600 were legend. You didn't even ask questions. You just bought the thing, right? You bought the game. Because Activision had that huge seal. And David Crane's name meant instant gold. Well, Transformers as a game was average. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that if you took the Transformer game disc, flipped it upside down, put it in your Commodore 64, and booted it up, you were treated to a 10-minute multimedia production talking about the history of Transformers. This was equivalent to a PowerPoint presentation nowadays. But what was amazing is this entire 10-minute piece was voice announced. That's right. For 10 minutes, you watched a show that had digital audio you could understand. You could understand what they were saying. And listen, speech synthesis is nothing now. Every game has voice. Every game has audio. And this goes back quite a while. But digital audio is not cheap in terms of storage. Now, remember, these are 160 kilobyte discs. 160K. Right? 160,000 letters. Right? When you open up a Word document, if you opened up a Word document empty and saved it, it would be bigger, far bigger than 160K with nothing in it. David Crane managed to squeeze all that audio, all the pictures, and everything into 160K 10-minute self-running demo. It is something for me that will be, I could have Alzheimer's and be near death, and I will still remember David Crane's amazing Transformer game. Not for the game, but for the amazing demo on the other side. 1986 actually had a relatively excellent amount of games come out for it. Some of the titles that you may recognize, 10th Frame Bowling, right? I've talked about 10th Frame Bowling many times. That came from Access Software, by the way, Bruce Carver. Access, they were also responsible for Leaderboard Golf. They were responsible for Beachhead, Beachhead 2, Raid Over Moscow. Access was a huge name, and they had top-notch technology coming out. 10th Frame Bowling was the most amazing bowling game that came out for decades to come. Absolutely true. Alter Ego, which, by the way, since we're talking about Alter Ego, a lot of you know I think Alter Ego is one of the greatest experiences anybody can have. And I say that not because it's an amazing game, but it's a psychology game that takes you from birth to death, giving you situations that you answer, and your answers will lead you down one path or another. What makes this game so amazing, it was written by psychologists, and if you were to do everything that you would normally do, right, if you were to live your virtual life and make the same answers, do the same things, when you got to the age that you were, you could look at who you are. There's a snapshot called Spheres of Influence, and you could flip over to that, and it would show you your physical capabilities, your social standing, your intellect, all of these different things. It started building your profile. Now, remember, this is on an 8-bit computer in 1986, people. This may not sound amazing now, but what an experience. And it lets you go through life as either a male or a female. And as an adolescent boy at the time, playing as a female gave me a very interesting, unique perspective on the fairer sex. So, for what it's worth, Alter Ego is now an Android app. You can actually download the Alter Ego game itself with all the questions and all of the paths and all of the features, except for one. You can't. You don't take the introductory quiz, which I think starts to shape your spheres ahead of time. They left that out. I don't know why. I've got an email into them. But suffice to say, Alter Ego to me was one of those things that helped me fashion my life. I was able to see myself somehow objectively and say, listen, if I was going to be the bully, if I was going to be the butthead, if I did become a bad person, I could play that life out and see where it led me. And it was non-judgmental. There wasn't any purpose to try to make, you know, evil is punished. No, it was factual. It was amazing. It was entertaining. It was exciting to me. And the other nice thing about it, too, is when you're, you know, 16, 17 years old, this game dealt with adult situations. So a lot of times, it wasn't dirty, but, you know, when you're 16, anything that's an adult situation like that makes you think you're getting away with something, you know? So that was kind of fun. So that also came out in 1986. Let's see, what else? Gunship, right? Sci-Fi Trading Company, Ultimate Wizard, which I've talked a lot about. Tons of different things came out. Karateka or Karateka, depending on how you pronounce it. I know what they say it's pronounced, but that's a long story. We can go into that another time. But 1986 was still a very good year for games. 1987 brought us a couple of really, really neat things for the Commodore 64. By 1987, I was graduating high school, so quite frankly, I had a lot less time to work on my computer and a lot more time getting ready to figure out what I was going to do with my life. But 1987 came out with something really, really cool. And a lot of people don't even know this thing existed because it had such a short lifespan. Did you know the Commodore 64 and the 128 had a 3.5-inch floppy drive? That's right. Called the 1581 drive. And we're going to talk about it in great detail in the hardware segment. But yeah, there was a 3.5-inch floppy drive for the Commodore 64. And it was amazing. But we'll talk more about that later. Also, get this, the most famous, now there were a couple before the Lieutenant Colonel came out, but Lieutenant Colonel came out with, get this, a 20 megabyte hard drive for the Commodore 64. Now, 20 megabytes, when a full disk is only 160 kilobytes, you got to do the math here. So you're figuring what? You could put, in 1 megabyte, you could put 8 floppies, right? That's with no compression, right? Just a raw pickup of the data. That's, let's see, so what's the math on that? 160K times 10 would be 1.6, so more like 8. So 8 floppies per megabyte. So literally you could put 16 floppy disks on this drive. That's insane. 20 megabytes. And also the 1764 RAM expander unit came out. Now, the 1764 RAM expansion unit offered up like quadruple the memory of your Commodore 64. Now, it was really put out there for GEOS, right? Graphic operating system takes a lot more memory. So that's what it was really used for, although some people came up with some clever hacks for it. And also, one of the very first, it may be the first, the history's a little fuzzy on some of these things, folks. 1987 also saw the Super Snapshot cartridge. We're going to talk more about hardware and Snapshot cartridges and pirate cartridges, but that's when the Super Snapshot came out. 1987 also saw a handful of fairly notable games, including Airborne Ranger, Arkanoid, Boulder Dash, California Games, Echelon, which, by the way, was the first game to use a microphone that you could control with your voice. Now, granted, it wasn't all that authentic, but it literally you could fire your weapons by saying fire with your voice with a microphone. That was pretty cool. Legacy of the Ancients, Maniac Mansion, Skate or Die, Whizball, some really nice titles, right? Good stuff. The total sales of the Commodore 64 and the 128 by 1988, beginning January, 7 million units. Now, we're starting to get a little long in the lifespan here. We're talking about a 6-year-old computer at this point. 1988 came around and offered us Death Sword, Outrun, Questron 2, Rambo 3, Traz, Zack McCracken, and Cinemaware titles. You know, it came from the desert, those sort of titles. Now, there's got to be some problem with my numbers here because Questron 2 came out before Legacy of the Ancients. So there's a couple of titles that are out of order here, but you get the idea. Between 1984 and 1987, 88 was really the golden years of gaming for me. So by 1988, we also had seen $84 million of software sales. That's absolutely incredible. 1989 saw some titles like SimCity, Shoot 'em Up Construction Set, and of course the venerable Curse of the Azure Bonds, which were the original gold box games from SSI. Then we have to fast forward a little bit. Now, they were still selling units and there was still stuff going on, but you have to understand, you know, they had bigger fish to fry, especially come 1994. When two of the largest components of Commodore, Commodore International and Commodore Electronics filed for liquidation. So by 1994, the show was pretty much over. Now that doesn't mean that the Commodore 64 disappeared into obscurity. The Commodore 64 continued to be a popular machine. I had friends of mine that actually had multiple Commodore 64s. They were dirt cheap by now, folks. We're talking $99. So literally, a friend of mine, John Barta, who I talk about a lot on this show and my other shows, John Barta actually had, I think at one time, 4 or 5 Commodore 64s. He had one for himself, one for his wife, and I think he had a guest Commodore 64 at one time. He had one hooked up to X10 that would control all of his lights in his house, as well as to control his sprinkler system, right, and his outside lighting. So it was really impressive. So he had a dedicated Commodore 64 for that. So a lot of people continued to champion the cause of the Commodore 64. The Commodore 64 also saw more life later on, right? One of the most recent and most notable things that the Commodore 64 has seen in the spotlight, Jerry Ellsworth, who is a wonderful gal, by the way. I've met her. I've done an interview with her, as you probably heard on this particular show. Very, very intelligent, amazing woman. She created something called the Commodore 64 Direct-to-TV, or DTV unit. This was essentially one of those plug into your TV controllers, right? And this had 30 built-in games. We're going to talk more about this on another show, but I want to talk about it now too, because it was just that amazing. It was essentially the Commodore 64 reduced onto a little tiny board with a joystick built in with all sorts of neat little enhancements. And again, I've got this all covered in the hardware segment. But this was an amazing thing, because we were dealing, up until now, we were dealing with crappy Pac-Man joysticks that you plugged into your TV, Dora the Explorer joysticks you plugged into your TV, and then all of a sudden, out of the ashes came the Phoenix, a Commodore 64 all-in-one unit that plugged into the TV, and it was accurate. You could play summer games, you could play Iridium, you could play, you know, these 30 different games, and it was amazing. And, of course, the Commodore 64 still lives on through Commodore 64 Forever, c64forever.com. Compliments of Cloanto, who, of course, make the fantastic Amiga Forever turnkey package as well. So you could immediately get in on Commodore 64 fun by getting in on the Commodore 64 Forever thing. And there are still people today. There's a large number of enthusiasts. There's a large number of hackers. People are still writing games for Commodore 64. They're still writing mega demos for Commodore 64. And indeed, some people are still making music with their Commodore 64. There are several retro bands like 8-Bit and some others that actually use real Commodore 64s as part of their band. It's part of the whole deal. It's part of the retro feel, and they can actually inject that music in real time, because the Commodore 64 was really kind of an instrument all on its own. So it was truly an amazing thing. The Commodore 64, even by 1994, now this is a remarkable number to me, right? In 1994, when Commodore started liquidation, they still sold like 60,000 Commodore 64s. 12 years later, Commodore was still able to turn around and sell. It was 60 to 80. There was a number in there somewhere. It was either 60 or 80. I'll err on the side of caution and say it was 60. 60,000 units, 12 years later, and there are still enthusiasts still using this thing. It's absolutely incredible. The Commodore 64 was my Wonder Years, right? It was the Wonder Year device. I had a VIC-20, but the Commodore 64 was my compadre through high school, junior high school, during those memorable years of my life. And I know it was for a lot of you, too, which is why I wanted to talk about it. Now, I understand that this episode is going to be a little bit short. It's only going to be about an hour long. But again, it's a belated show, and I apologize. But this is a good kickoff to talk about the rest of the stuff, because we've got... Let me bring my notes up here. We have, coming up in the next shows, hardware. We're going to talk about all the machines, all the Commodore 64 machines. We're going to tell you all sorts of interesting little tidbits about the machines. We're going to talk to you about, did you know that there was a Commodore 64 game console? We're going to talk to you about that. We're going to tell you all this good stuff. We're going to talk about a Commodore 64 portable. Did you know there was a laptop Commodore 64? More like a tabletop Commodore 64, the luggable. I'm going to tell you about that. We're going to talk about all the cool peripherals that came out, the cassette drive, the floppy drive. We're going to talk to you about all the different models of floppy drives that came out, some of the interesting intricacies of those units. We're going to tell you about, I've got a whole bunch of notes here. We're going to talk to you about the hard drives that came out, the memory expanders, all sorts of other little niche devices that nobody knows about. We'll talk about modems and monitors, the whole bit, on the next show for March. And then finally, in April's show, we are going to talk about the software, and we're going to talk about the piracy. The Commodore 64 is legendary for piracy, and I've got tons of stuff to talk to you about. We're going to talk about the snapshot cartridges. We're going to talk to you about the fast hack'ems, the parameter copiers, the insane things that people hooked up to their hardware to copy games. And we're going to talk about some people that really made a difference in the Commodore 64's lifetime. Programmers, developers, hardware, software, figureheads. We've got tons to talk about. And of course, I've got some trivia and some stories for you too. So those are all coming up on future shows. This one's going to be a little short. I apologize, but at least you'll have this to tide you over until the March show. So I hope you enjoyed it. We've only begun to touch the Commodore 64. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying, until next time, which isn't far off, keep it retro. Hello, folks. You are listening to the February 2013 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, better late than never, I say. This is the February program. It comes out a little bit late, but you'll be happy to know that the next few shows are going to be our Commodore 64 anniversary special. Now, those of you who used to listen to Retro Gaming Radio back in the classic days know that I did a four-piece show on the Amiga computer. The Commodore 64 is one of the greatest computers of all time, and here on Retro Gaming Radio, we're going to give that fantastic computer its due. So for the next couple of episodes, we will not be running the standard format of the show. We won't have bits and bytes or some of the other regular pieces, but instead, we're going to focus full-time on this fantastic computer. This month, we're going to talk about the history of the Commodore 64. We're going to talk all about its beginnings and its ends and all the stops it made along the way. In future shows, we're going to look over the software and the hardware that make this such an amazing computer. And then I've got, of course, some great stories to tell you. So I hope you enjoy, sit back, relax, and let's relive the Commodore 64. The Commodore 64 was released by Commodore in September of 1982. Now, the Commodore 64 started off at a price tag of $595. Now, that sounds expensive, right, considering most of us that wear wristwatches have more power in our wristwatch, our cell phone. Pretty much any device you could lay your hands on right now has 100 times more power than the Commodore 64. But it's worth noting that the $595 price tag was very important to Commodore in 1982 because other microcomputers cost almost double, and in some cases triple, $595. So for Commodore to be able to come out with a machine, a micro machine, for that price at that time frame was very, very important. It's worth noting that the Commodore 64 sold over 20 million units in its lifetime. At one point, it was estimated that in the United States, there was a Commodore 64 in one of every four homes. That's an amazing number. 1982 was a great year. When we talk about Commodore and being great years, the Commodore 64 was not an expandable, very much of an expandable computer. These days, we have PCs that you can just pull the video card out and put another one in, pull the sound card out, put another one in. This was not a modular device. This was pretty much what you see is what you get. So maybe it's worth going over the basic specs of the Commodore 64. The Commodore 64 used a 6502 processor, depending on what region of the world you were in, ran just under or just over 1 megahertz. Now, let me repeat that one more time. 1 megahertz. Not 1 gigahertz. 1 megahertz. It used a VIC-2 chip for graphics at 320 by 200 resolution. Now again, 320 pixels by 200 pixels. Pretty much the lowest resolution computer that you could lay your hands on today with the worst monitor possible would still be double that resolution. It was capable of 16 colors, which was actually pretty miraculous at the time considering most microcomputers were black and white. It also featured some things like hardware sprites and raster interrupts. These were very important to graphics. Let's talk a little bit about that because it's part of what makes the Commodore 64 so amazing. Hardware sprites. Think of a sprite as something on the screen that moves around. The player, the monster, an arrow, a bullet. You may have heard it called player missile graphics. Well, in the case of the Commodore 64, these player missile graphics didn't have just software built in to handle them. In some cases, as I recall, the Atari 400-800 had something called player missile graphics, but it was more of an API to help you use graphics to do players and missiles and weapons and bad guys and the whole bit. The Commodore 64 actually had hardware to control those, which means to get the same sort of effect on other microcomputers, you would have a lot of flickering. You would have a lot of dirt, what we call ghosting, or little specks, right? Artifacting on the graphics. Well, because they're controlled by the hardware, you could get away with doing some miraculous things with sprites that you really couldn't get away with doing on other microcomputers at the time. Raster interrupts allowed you to tap into the hardware and actually tell the hardware to control things in your stead. But here's the cool part. If you've done any programming, you know that typically speaking, if you're writing a game, you'll have a main loop, and the main loop essentially changes values, moves where the graphics are going to be, then paints the graphics, wash, rinse, and repeat. Raster interrupts allowed you to actually tap into the hardware and say, at certain periodicities, at certain time frames, update these graphics. So you could almost have, look at it as almost multitasking on a computer that's made in 1982. So these sort of unbelievable, even though the resolution wasn't incredible, the unbelievable features of the hardware, the graphics hardware, really made a huge difference in the Commodore 64. And if you've gamed on one, you know what I'm talking about. The Commodore 64 boasted 64 kilobytes, not megabytes, not gigabytes, but 64 kilobytes of RAM. Now, for those of you who are well-versed in Commodore 64, you know when you turn the Commodore 64 on, it will only tell you that you have 38,000 bytes to work with. Some of that was reserved for the system. It still had 64K, just not necessarily 64K usable. But some people got around that, and I'll talk about more about that in the story section of this program. Now, what really set the Commodore 64 apart, now, the graphics were fantastic. It was an amazingly inexpensive computer for the time. But what really put the Commodore 64 miles ahead of everything else that had come before it was the SID chip, the sound interface device. SID, the 6581 chip, was actually a synthesizer. While there was Yamahas and other Kawasaki-type synthesizers out on the market, actual keyboards that could do these incredible things, to have one in a computer was simply unheard of. Most monochrome computers got to beep or play what they called speaker sounds, which was this tinny, hollow, one tone with a variation of pitch. You know what I'm talking about. It's just absolutely horrible. But the SID chip changed the way that computers thought about sound. It had three voices plus a noise channel. And it had all of the features that a synthesizer would have. Attack, decay, sustain, release. All of the things that could really make the Commodore 64 not just stand out graphically or by price, but by the audio. The sound that came out of it was simply amazing. And anybody who's been in the Commodore 64 area knows exactly what I'm talking about. And as the system progressed, they learned to do more and more with the Commodore 64 sound system. And we're going to talk more about how they expanded it with hardware later on. The system came complete with a few ports on it, two joystick ports, which were standard 9-pin ports. Commodore is very smart in some respects. Now, they're not smart in a lot of respects, but in some respects they were. They made their joystick ports compatible with the best-selling video game system of the time. That would be the Atari 2600. So you had two joystick ports, you could have two players at one time, a cartridge port on the backside, RF out so you could hook it up to any TV, audio video out using a special IEEE connector that would allow you to hook it up to an actual monitor at the time, a floppy printer IEEE port, a cassette tape plug, and an RS-232 port. So all in all, this thing was pretty expandable on the outside. Not necessarily on the inside, but you could do a lot of stuff with it on the outside, which was pretty neat. Here's an interesting little bit of trivia. The power supply to the Commodore 64, as you know, was affectionately known as the brick. Now, a lot of people wondered. Now, at the time, right, the IBM PC and a lot of the other computers at the time had the power supply built into the unit, which not only added great size to the unit, but it also added heat and other unpleasantness to those computers. Commodore decided that it would make sense to make an external power supply. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, it saves space in the unit, allowing the Commodore 64 to sit nice and cleanly on your desk. It also reduced heat that you would have to worry about being near your components on the inside. And finally, the one little piece of the equation I did not know about when I started researching this piece was the fact that the external power supply allowed them to easily change that power supply out in other countries, because most countries don't share the same type of power plug or the same voltage or anything else. So instead of actually having to manufacture new Commodore 64s for every different location, they could in fact simply replace the power supply. It also made it easy for users to replace the power supply. And that was important because as the Commodore 64 started powering more devices, it required more power draw. Just like today, if you put a very high-end video card in your PC, you may have to upgrade the power supply simply to drive the components themselves. So that was fantastic. It was very interesting, though. They were very protective of their power supply, Commodore. For those of you who have ever actually opened one of those power supplies, there's an amazing amount of epoxy resin. There's a gel inside that thing to actually keep you from getting inside and tampering with it. And I'm not sure if that was to prevent reverse engineering, or if it was just to protect the consumer from themselves, or if it just made sure that nobody would knock one of these things off and start selling them for cheap, which they ended up doing anyway. But that actually helped dissipate the heat of the power supply as well. So the epoxy resin was actually useful in many different aspects. So now you know a little bit about the hardware. Now, we're going to get into more details about this in future shows. However, this episode, we're going to talk strictly about the history of the Commodore 64 and some of the titles of games that came out that people remember, that people are would consider significant releases. Now, I threw a couple of games in there for myself that maybe a lot of you haven't heard of, and I did try to respect some of our overseas compadres who also liked the Commodore 64, but ended up playing some very different games than some of us did. So let's go back to 1982 in September. Again, the unit started off at $595. There was no floppy drive available at the time. However, there was something called a data set, a cassette recorder playback unit that plugged into the computer that you could save and load programs off of. As mentioned, over 20 million Commodore 64s sold by 1999 in October. 1982 saw some amazing games. Some of the games, now you've got to understand, there's a nostalgia for many of us, right? 1982, let's see, I graduated in 87, so 5 years before that. I wasn't in high school, I was in junior high school. So junior high school, these are the times that we tend to remember, that we tend to reminisce about, the times we go all nostalgia over. So a lot of these games mean a lot to me personally and a lot of my listeners who grew up around the same time frame. However, I do want to point out that nostalgia is not the only pair of glasses that one needs to wear to truly appreciate these games. Some of these games are still fun even today to play. In 1982, we saw a couple of really, really neat titles, right? We saw Choplifter, which everybody knows Choplifter, and in fact, it's still being redone today. Right, they just had a Choplifter HD that came out for consoles and for other devices. So Choplifter's been around a long time. Ford Apocalypse is one of the greatest games ever. It has you flying an attack helicopter through the caverns, through these caverns, taking out bad guys. It's an amazing experience that belies the fact that it's on an 8-bit computer from the past. And the other title that really came out notable in 1982 was Night Mission Pinball. Now, Night Mission Pinball was a fully functional pinball machine inside your Commodore 64. Now, a lot of people don't remember Night Mission Pinball. Instead, they remember some other things that we're going to talk about related to pinball in the near future here in a moment. In just a few months, now this is amazing to me. This shows, and we're going to talk more about this in a minute, but This shows an amazing ability of Commodore's not just to create a low-cost product, a quality product, but then to manufacture it down to a point to where they can make it even more affordable. We're going to talk about how the price changed over a very short period of time. By January of 1983, this is 4 months after the Commodore 64 came out, 4 months, the price dropped from $595 to $399 or $400. That's an amazing cut. What is that, 33%? I'd have to do the math, right? I didn't write down my math on my notes. But that's an insane amount of money to drop in a few months. So that's one of those things where you got to look at saying, okay, so it came out, everybody wanted it, but $600, there's no way. What about $400? Just 6 months later, Commodore dropped the dealer price, in other words, what the dealers could purchase them for, down to, get this, $200. This is within the first year, my friends. This is how smart and efficient Commodore was, that they could afford to do that. Now, they weren't losing any money. Okay, folks, let me just put it this way. They were not losing a single dime by lowering that price tag. They were continuing to make money. And we're going to talk about how that works in just a minute. By selling them for $200 to dealers, that dropped the retail price well under $250. The Commodore 64 was then affordable to almost anybody, especially when you start looking at the concept that the other computers were still running for a grand. You know what I'm saying? So this is absolutely a stunning deal. We now have one of the most powerful personal computers on the market, now down to under $250. Now that's 1983 dollars, of course, you know, so you'd have to adjust for inflation, but you got the idea. During the end of 1983, we saw Electronic Arts blossom. We all know who Electronic Arts is now, but Electronic Arts back in the old days was actually not a big evil corporation that kept their employees working 80-hour weeks and locking them into their campuses and paying them peanuts. Electronic Arts was a publishing house that really wanted to go out and get the top name talent, the top name software. So by October, they had released three landmark games that put Electronic Arts immediately on the map. These games would be Pinball Construction Set, which most people know a lot more than they know about Night Mission Pinball. The insanely popular game Mule. And, of course, one of my all-time favorite games from Freefall Associates, Archon. Archon has never been done right since the original incarnation of Archon on the Commodore 64. They've made sequels, they've made remakes, they've tried to do high-def versions. It just doesn't work. Archon was magic on its own. Now, in order to facilitate Electronic Arts, Commodore released the 1541 disk drive right around October of 1983. So within a year, the Commodore 64 had several top-notch games. They had a floppy drive, and they had Electronic Arts bringing some amazing talent. Some other notable titles that you might recognize from 1983. Now listen, 1983 must be the greatest year of gaming of all time. As I read you these titles, just think about it. 1983, listen to the lineup. The original Beachhead, Blue Max, Burnin' Rubber, Dino Eggs, Crush Crumble Chomp, Temple of Abshai, Forbidden Forest, Grid Runner, Hover Bover, Jumpman, Load Runner, Miner 2049er, Pharaoh's Curse, Telengard. Now, this is just a small sampling, folks, just in case you're wondering. I didn't list them all. But I listed the ones that I thought a lot of people would recognize, that a lot of people would be like, holy crap, 1983 was insane. And it was. David Crane's mythological Ghostbusters hit the Commodore 64 by mid-1984. And by the end of 1984, they had sold 3.5 million units by December 1984. So we're talking 2 years, just a little bit above 2 years. They'd had two good Christmas seasons, technically three, but if you released it in September, that's a little tight. So they had two full Christmas seasons, 3.5 million units shipped. Unbelievable. I know what you're thinking. Well, what else came out in 1984? There's got to be some other great games. If 1983 was the gold, 1984 was the silver. Let's go over the big titles. Decathlon, which single-handedly broke wrists and joysticks simultaneously. Aztec Challenge, BC's Quest for Tires, Bruce Lee, Chucky Egg, David's Midnight Magic, the other pinball machine everyone knows, Gateway to Abshai, Gyrus, Hero, Impossible Mission, Jet Set Willy, Dr. J and Larry Bird Go One-on-One, David Crane's Pitfall, Raid Over Moscow, Raid on Bungling Bay, Seven Cities of Gold, Space Taxi, Spy Hunter, Spy vs. Spy, Toy Bazaar. All 1984, if you can believe it. Definitely the silver medal. In 1985, the Commodore 128 gets announced. And we also see the first fast loader cartridge called the Mach 5. Now, of course, we all know what the Mach 5 reference is, and if you don't, you're just not geeky enough to be listening to the show. The Mach 5, of course, was the name of Speed Racer's infamous car, the Mach 5. It was also a fairly decent fast loader cartridge. Of course, that's not the one that everybody remembers, is it? No, that title goes to the Epix fast load cartridge, which we're going to be talking about in great detail later on. 1985 also saw a bunch of big names. If 1983 was the gold, 1984 was the silver, 1985 would definitely take the bronze medal. Now, a lot of people who are a bit younger than me, just by a tad bit, for them, this is, I mean, there's a lot of titles in here that people will go, oh my God, that's like, that totally trumps anything in 1983 or 1984. I beg to differ. But let me run down the list and you'll tell me what you think. 1985 saw the release of the big-name titles. Most of the Lucasfilm games came out, like Ball Blazer, Rescue on Fractalis, the infamous Bard's Tale. Activision started pumping out some really good titles, like Hacker, which, by the way, the logon password is Australia. Elite, of course, that's a huge fan favorite. F-15 Strike Eagle, Beachhead 2, Little Computer People, The Last V8, Paradroid, Way of the Exploding Fist. All of these fantastic titles, right? This would be my high school years. So obviously, by then I had a pretty decent Commodore 64 collection going on. One of the huge things that happened in the history of telecommunications happened in 1985. A little thing called QuantumLink started up. QuantumLink was also affectionately known as Q-Link. And Q-Link truly changed the way that people communicated. Now listen, at this point in time, let me see if I've got a number for right about now, how many units were out there. I'm figuring we're in the 4 to 4.5 million units. So Q-Link was the first nationwide pay bulletin board system. What does that mean for those of you who are not quite of age to appreciate it? QuantumLink was a combination of software and your modem. Now when I say modem, I'm not talking cable modem. I'm not talking about, 56K modem. I'm talking about really, really old modems. And we're going to talk a lot about that in the hardware portion of the show. Q-Link actually came on a disc. Now, this is what's important. Now, we had bulletin boards by then. We had the ones where you would call out on your modem and some text would come on the screen. It would say log in and you type in your name and you type in your password. And maybe you would have some block graphics or something that would slowly draw in. But for the most part, it was a plain textual interface. and bulletin boards at the time could only support one, maybe two people online at the same time. So a standard bulletin board would have somebody call, read messages, leave their responses, right? Leave their responses, hang up. The next person would call. They would read all the messages, leave their responses, hang up, and this would continue 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that's actually, you know, that's sort of the precursor to social networking, if you will, right? Because most of the time, now, I know there's obviously there's some variances in this, but typically speaking, if you go up to Google Plus, or you go up to Facebook, or you go up to Twitter, you read, you respond, and then you come back later and wash, rinse, and repeat, right? That's how regular BBSs were back in the early 80s. And there were a lot of these. Q-Link became the first nationwide, I wouldn't call it an ISP, but I would call it a nationwide bulletin board where hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people could be connected online at the same time. Now, I know what you're thinking. There was CompuServe, there was Genie, there were some other ones out there that offered something similar. You could be in a text chat room with 50 people. It wasn't impossible. Q-Link took it one step further. Instead of saying, use your favorite terminal software to call CompuServe or Genie or what was the other one, Prodigy, instead of calling up with your software, we're going to give you a disk, and this is how you're going to get into the system. And as soon as you put that disk in and booted it, it was a world. It was a full color. It was graphics. It was beautiful interface. It was something that even the diehard bulletin board people had to look at and go, holy crap, that's insane. And as Q-Link got bigger, they offered online games, blackjack, slots, right? This is 1985. Right? This is almost 30 years ago. They were playing online blackjack on Commodore 64s in full color with graphics. So it's important to understand what Q-Link really meant to the world. This pushed the CompuServes and the Genies and all these other ones. It pushed them to better themselves. Oddly enough, Q-Link also was a file repository. So Q-Link kind of offered several different things. It offered bulletin board style, you know, leave a message, read a message, leave a message, right? It allowed real-time chat with a variety of different chat rooms. It also had a file server, right? And then, of course, later on it had games added to it. The file server became a huge means of exchange, not piracy. There was plenty of that going on, but it wasn't on Q-Link. In fact, they watched very closely to maintain a very clean system. Most bulletin boards couldn't say the same. But what Q-Link started was a musical revolution. Now remember, we had the Commodore 64 here. A complete synthesizer. A real synthesizer. Three voice, one waveform. You could make insane music with this thing. A guy by the name of Craig Chamberlain came out with something called Sid Player. And Sid Player blew me away. Still today, I can be entranced with Sid Player. What is Sid Player? Sid Player was a visual music playback machine that showed you a full two-row keyboard. And as the music would play, as the notes would play, or the sound effects would play, you would actually see the keys light up. Technically speaking, if you wanted to teach yourself piano, you could go and download, you know, a Beethoven song or Bach, and if, you know, it didn't have a lot of weird, you know, audio effects added to it, it was just a piano sound, you could learn how to play piano with this thing. Sid Player came out and blew everybody away, but what really was important was Sid Edit, or the Sid Editor, which let you make the music to play inside of Sid Player. Quantum Link, or Q-Link, became a repository. It became an outlet for hundreds, thousands of musicians to gather, exchange music, exchange ideas, and corroborate with each other. It was an amazing thing to live through. I talk often about, in Passenger Seat Radio, my other show, I talk a lot about being there when it happened, right? I was there when MP3 first took hold. I was there. I wrote, oddly enough, this is my claim to fame that nobody knows about, I wrote the first graphical MP3 encoder that the world had ever seen, which I still had a copy so I could prove it. Made in Visual Basic, what was it, 3, 4, whatever it was at the time. But there are certain times in history, and it doesn't happen anymore, by the way, because everything is just handed to you. Everything is just there. To actually be present during a time frame, a relatively short time frame, a year or two, to see something that really changed the world, whether anybody knows it changed it or not, Quantum Link changed the world. And it may surprise you or not surprise you to find out that Quantum Link evolved. Once the Commodore 64 went its merry way, Q-Link took its back-end systems, repurposed it, and became, get this, the original biggest ISP of all time, America Online. In fact, there are hints, if you go and search for Quantum Link, and you can see pictures, graphic pictures in the chat rooms and things like that, you will actually see well-known America Online things like People Connection. That was the chat rooms, was People Connection. So I'm no fan of AOL, but AOL would have never existed if not for Quantum Link. And AOL definitely, whether you like AOL or not, and I do not, whether you like it or not, it connected people in a mass frenzy that it would have taken them longer to get together had we waited for the inevitable evolution of the internet. Quantum Link started it all on the Commodore 64. It wasn't available. I want to say that there eventually was a Q-Link available for like the Atari computers, but it was pretty much a Commodore 64 club only, which was fine because there was like 4 million of them out there to be had. And a lot of them had modems. And I know what you're thinking. Well, the Commodore 64 didn't come with a modem. What's the conversion rate there? Ah, they started giving modems away with the computers. Now, that's another story altogether. I don't want to get into that. I've already kind of segued off on Q-Link, but it was so important in Commodore's history that Q-Link, SID Player, and the entire faction around that is so important we had to talk about it at length for me to feel happy about it. 1985 also saw Commodore attempt to stop production on the Commodore 64. See, Commodore wanted to move ahead. They wanted to move forward. They wanted to make the Commodore 128 their new flagship. They wanted to get the Commodore Amiga to be their flagship, right? They couldn't understand why the Commodore 64 continued to hold on, right? They didn't expect it to last as long as it did. So they tried to stop production. The public demanded more. They opened production back up. This happened several times during 1985. Berkeley Softworks came up with a little something that you may or may not have heard of called GEOS, the Graphical Environment Operating System. This was introduced in January of 1986. Now, the Commodore 128 had been out for about a year, and Commodore was pretty sure that if they could, they saw GEOS. They knew what GEOS represented. GEOS, just to give you an example, if you, we'll have links and stuff for you, of course, but to understand what GEOS is, if you remember the black and white original monochrome Mac computers, right? The ones that people make fish aquariums and stuff out of now, they're like collector pieces. Those little rectangular boxes that sat on your desk with the little tiny viewport in them and the disk drive underneath. Those are the black and white Macs I'm talking about. GEOS in 86 rather, GEOS provided that interface and then some. So it was a very big thing. Commodore saw that this was going to be the future, and they really wanted GEOS and the Commodore 128 to be a marriage. Well, the Commodore 128 had some problems getting started, even though the Commodore 128 was actually a remarkably decent machine. The Commodore 128 fell by the wayside for a simple reason, that it was 99.99999% backward compatible with, you got it, the Commodore 64. In fact, on the 128, if you powered the computer up holding down the Commodore key, it would boot directly into the Commodore 64 mode. You could also type Go 64 on the in the command line interpreter there and hit enter, and it would also take you to the Commodore 64. Now, when we talk about hardware, you're going to learn all sorts of nasty stuff about the 128 and the also the Commodore 64C, which we're going to talk about in a minute, that did not make these what I would call 100% compatible. But Commodore was banking on the concept that you would get the 128 knowing you had backward compatibility, but then you'd stay for the GEOS, right? We're going to talk more about the 128 and the hardware segment because there's a reason why Commodore was banking on it. And when you spread yourself thin between two computers, it doesn't always work out the best. So GEOS was introduced in January of 1986. And June, a few months later, about 6 months later, about halfway through the year, Commodore decided, okay, fine. You guys want Commodore 64s? We'll give you freaking Commodore 64s. So they retooled it, they cleaned it up a little bit, and they called it the C64C. They also released a special C edition of the 1541. This was designed to be the... Okay, listen, you're not going to buy 128s. We got it. However, we still want you to use GEOS. We think this is the future. And honestly, I think they wanted people on GEOS because it was a gateway drug to the Amiga, right? You had the Commodore 64, blue screen, white letters, you type stuff in. Then you had GEOS, which was still black and white, but it was a graphic environment. Then the next step up, after you've had a little marijuana, right, because that's the gateway drug, then you upped yourself to the hard stuff, the crystal meth, the Amiga. Full color, all the audio, the whole bit. This is not an Amiga show. But they really wanted GEOS to be the gateway drug to the Amiga. If we can get them to use GEOS, they will upgrade to the Amiga. It's a logical progression. So the C64C and the 1541C came bundled with GEOS. So they were trying to make it work. This is a piece of the timeline. 1986 was important to me because of one title that came out. And the game itself was nothing to look at. Honestly, it wasn't even that good of a game, to be honest with you. But a little game called Transformers came out for the Commodore 64. It was created by the legendary master of all, David Crane. Now, why does this even register a blip on the Commodore 64 radar? Heck, a lot of you probably don't even know where I'm going with this or know what I'm talking about. But David Crane, as you know from Ghostbusters, right, he had a way of pushing hardware to the limit. That's when he worked at Activision for the Atari 2600, right? David Crane games were legend. Activision games on the 2600 were legend. You didn't even ask questions. You just bought the thing, right? You bought the game. Because Activision had that huge seal. And David Crane's name meant instant gold. Well, Transformers as a game was average. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that if you took the Transformer game disc, flipped it upside down, put it in your Commodore 64, and booted it up, you were treated to a 10-minute multimedia production talking about the history of Transformers. This was equivalent to a PowerPoint presentation nowadays. But what was amazing is this entire 10-minute piece was voice announced. That's right, for 10 minutes, you watched a show that had digital audio you could understand. You could understand what they were saying. And listen, speech synthesis is nothing now. Every game has voice, every game has audio, and this goes back quite a while. But digital audio is not cheap in terms of storage. Now, remember, these are 160 kilobyte discs. 160K. Right? 160,000 letters. Right? When you open up a Word document, if you opened up a Word document empty and saved it, it would be bigger, far bigger than 160K with nothing in it. David Crane managed to squeeze all that audio, all the pictures, and everything into a 160K 10-minute self-running demo. It is something for me that will be, I could have Alzheimer's and be near death, and I will still remember David Crane's amazing Transformer game. Not for the game, but for the amazing demo on the other side. 1986 actually had a relatively excellent amount of games come out for it. Some of the titles that you may recognize, 10th Frame Bowling, right? I've talked about 10th Frame Bowling many times. That came from Access Software, by the way, Bruce Carver. Access, they were also responsible for Leaderboard Golf. They were responsible for Beachhead, Beachhead 2, Raid Over Moscow. Access was a huge name, and they had top-notch technology coming out. 10th Frame Bowling was the most amazing bowling game that came out for decades to come. Absolutely true. Alter Ego, which, by the way, since we're talking about Alter Ego, a lot of you know I think Alter Ego is one of the greatest experiences anybody can have. And I say that not because it's an amazing game, but it's a psychology game that takes you from birth to death, giving you situations that you answer. And your answers will lead you down one path or another. What makes this game so amazing, it was written by psychologists, and if you were to do everything that you would normally do, right? If you were to live your virtual life and make the same answers, do the same things, when you got to the age that you were, you could look at who you are. There's a snapshot called Spheres of Influence, and you could flip over to that, and it would show you your physical capabilities, your social standing, your intellect, all of these different things. It started building your profile. Now, remember, this is on an 8-bit computer in 1986, people. This may not sound amazing now, but what an experience. And it lets you go through life as either a male or a female. And as an adolescent boy at the time, playing as a female gave me a very interesting, unique perspective on the fairer sex. So, for what it's worth, Alter Ego is now an Android app. You can actually download the Alter Ego game itself with all the questions and all of the paths and all of the features, except for one. You can't. You don't take the introductory quiz, which I think starts to shape your spheres ahead of time. They left that out. I don't know why. I've got an email into them. But suffice to say, Alter Ego to me was one of those things that helped me fashion my life. I was able to see myself somehow objectively and say, listen, if I was going to be the bully, if I was going to be the butthead, if I did become a bad person, I could play that life out and see where it led me. And it was non-judgmental. There wasn't any purpose to try to make, you know, evil is punished. No, it was factual. It was amazing. It was entertaining. It was exciting to me. And the other nice thing about it, too, is when you're, you know, 16, 17 years old, this game dealt with adult situations. So a lot of times, it wasn't dirty, but, you know, when you're 16, anything that's an adult situation like that makes you think you're getting away with something, you know? So that was kind of fun. So that also came out in 1986. Let's see, what else? Gunship, right? Sci-Fi Trading Company, Ultimate Wizard, which I've talked a lot about. Tons of different things came out. Karateka or Karateka, depending on how you pronounce it. I know what they say it's pronounced, but that's a long story. We can go into that another time. But 1986 was still a very good year for games. 1987 brought us a couple of really, really neat things for the Commodore 64. By 1987, I was graduating high school, so quite frankly, I had a lot less time to work on my computer and a lot more time getting ready to figure out what I was going to do with my life. But 1987 came out with something really, really cool. And a lot of people don't even know this thing existed because it had such a short lifespan. Did you know the Commodore 64 and the 128 had a 3.5-inch floppy drive? That's right. Called the 1581 drive. And we're going to talk about it in great detail in the hardware segment. But yeah, there was a 3.5-inch floppy drive for the Commodore 64. And it was amazing. But we'll talk more about that later. Also, get this, the most famous, now there were a couple before the Lieutenant Colonel came out, but Lieutenant Colonel came out with, get this, a 20 megabyte hard drive for the Commodore 64. Now, 20 megabytes when a full disk is only 160 kilobytes? You got to do the math here. So you're figuring what? You could put in 1 megabyte, you could put 8 floppies, right? That's with no compression, right? Just a raw pickup of the data. That's, let's see. So what's the math on that? 160K times 10 would be 1.6, so more like 8. So 8 floppies per megabyte. So literally you could put 16 floppy disks on this drive. That's insane. 20 megabytes. And also the 1764 RAM expander unit came out. Now, the 1764 RAM expansion unit offered up like quadruple the memory of your Commodore 64. Now, it was really put out there for GEOS, right? Graphic operating system takes a lot more memory. So that's what it was really used for, although some people came up with some clever hacks for it. And also, one of the very first, it may be the first, the history's a little fuzzy on some of these things, folks. 1987 also saw the Super Snapshot cartridge. We're going to talk more about hardware and snapshot cartridges and pirate cartridges, but that's when the Super Snapshot came out. 1987 also saw a handful of fairly notable games, including Airborne Ranger, Arkanoid, Boulder Dash, California Games, Echelon,